Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to tackle this hour on our News Buzz edition with quick conversations. Let's tackle this first of all from yesterday. Governor Kim Reynolds appointed a new director of our state's Department of Human Services. Her name is Kelly Kennedy Garcia. She's a top health official who comes to Iowa from Texas. Let's learn more about her appointment from IPR's state government reporter, Katarina Sestarek. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us about this selection. What's her background?
Right now, Kelly Kennedy Garcia is a Deputy Executive Commissioner of the Texas Health and Human Services Commission. She's been working there for a few years. Before this, she was in a role that involved oversight of Medicaid, which the Department of Human Services in Iowa oversees. She's also worked for the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission, which kind of studies whether state agencies should be kept in place or abolished. And she also worked for former Texas Republican Governor Rick Perry.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what the governor, our governor, had to say about this selection.
Governor Reynolds said that she really liked the energy and passion that Garcia brought to their conversation, and that she talked a lot about bringing the team together and giving staff the tools they need to succeed in their jobs. So she just said that she's really excited about Garcia coming to Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, give us some background here, because of course the last few months have been filled with news about the Iowa's DHS, the Department of Human Services. Remind us of the fraught circumstances that Kelly Kennedy Garcia now enters.
Right. So in mid-June, Reynolds' staff kind of abruptly ousted Jerry Foxhoven, who is the former director of the Iowa Department of Human Services. There's still not much information out there about why that happened and so quickly, but that's sort of the void that Garcia is stepping into. The Department of Public Health's director, Garrett Claybaugh, has been filling that role on an interim basis for now. But there's still a lot of questions surrounding Foxhoven's departure, and this is also, of course, in the middle of ongoing questions about the state's privately managed Medicaid system, which just in July, there was a company, a private insurance company, that departed the state and a new one that came in, so that's going to be a lot for Garcia to handle as well when she steps into this new role. Continued issues with provider payments and still people saying that care that they need is being denied. And that's another thing that's sort of interesting is Texas is also a state that has privately managed Medicaid, and they've also had problems with it. Reporting there has revealed that people have been denied care, and reporters asked Reynolds if she's concerned that she's bringing in a director that's coming from a state that's also had problems like that, but she said she's not concerned about it.
So, Katarina, what did the governor have to say about why she wants someone new in that role?
She's repeatedly said that there were a lot of factors involved in her decision to ask for Foxhoven's resignation, and then she said that she wants to take the agency in a new direction, but she hasn't really given details about that. So I asked her yesterday again to describe that new direction, and this is what she said when I asked her what she wants Garcia to do differently than Foxhoven.
I don't believe the agency is where it should be. So I think there are opportunities for us to do things better when we're more efficient, when we're utilizing innovation and technology and collaboration. I think giving our employees the tools that they need to provide those services to Iowans. So I'm not going to be prescriptive on do this, do this, do this. I'm bringing her expertise into the department, somebody from outside that can lift the hood and take a look at what's currently being done and look for opportunities to do that more efficiently, more effectively, from a collaborative standpoint.
Okay, Governor Kim Reynolds there talking about her new appointment to the Iowa Department of Human Services to head it, Kelly Kennedy Garcia. And before I let you go, Katarina Sestarek, talk a little bit about the Jerry Foxhoven lawsuit, which is part of this as well.
That's right. Jerry Foxhoven, the former DHS director, has filed a complaint with the State Appeal Board, which is the first step toward filing a lawsuit against the state. He wants $2 million in a whistleblower retaliation claim. He's saying that the governor's office fired him because he wanted to get a legal opinion about a pay sharing agreement they had. He wasn't sure if it was the right thing that they should be doing. And he's claiming that that's why he was let go. And Reynolds has said that he never raised those concerns to her or her staff.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it and look for your further reporting. Katerina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter, with an update on the Iowa Department of Human Services with its new head. It is the state's largest agency, $6.5 billion of annual budget, about 4,000 employees. Katerina, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, just looking at my screen now. Dreadful what happened in the Bahamas. We're just finding out now. Officials in the Bahamas, I'm reading from CNN right now, brought in more body bags, according to this last report, and coolers. The death toll from Hurricane Dorian rising to 30, hundreds remaining missing. Of course, that weakened hurricane skimming along North Carolina's coast as we speak. Still fierce winds, a dangerous storm surge, according to the National Hurricane Center. Last Sunday, the storm made landfall, a Category 5 hurricane in the Bahamas. Let's talk with the University of Iowa researcher who is finding more efficient methods to transport relief supplies to disaster areas. She was on our program just a few weeks ago. Ann Campbell is a professor in the Department of Business Analytics at the University of Iowa Tippie College of Business. Ann, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about your research in this area. We talked to you last time about airlines. This is something completely different that you focus on.
Yes, it's completely different, but the core connecting tissue is that I study logistics problems and how things move across the country and how to do that well. And I personally have taken a huge interest in disaster logistics, motivated by seeing the news and seeing all the reports about how long it takes supplies to get to different people who are affected. And it motivated me to want to figure out, are there things that we could do better? And really understanding how the logistics and supply chain problems after a disaster are really different than what a business faces, and, mm-hmm. and why a business can be so fast and why we can't be so fast at helping people. And so some of the things that I've really discovered from interviewing different people and reading about the different disasters is really one of the core issues is preparation. And preparing for something that hasn't happened before is sort of a challenging thing to do. But really the key to minimizing the impact of the event is as much preparation as you can do, because after the event has happened, it does take a while to get food, water, all those things transported to where they're needed. So the more things that you can have pre-positioned and ready, the better it can be for the recovery efforts. So one of the biggest lessons has been what you should pre-position and where you should pre-position it. And then one thing that's really different than in a regular business is, yes, to also look at the risk of what you're pre-positioning. Because if you think about the Bahamas, if they had gotten a lot of things in storage and they put it anywhere in Grand Bahama, it would have been destroyed. And so when you're thinking about where Home Depot should have their warehouse, they're not thinking so much about the likelihood of it being destroyed. But in a disaster preparation, you have to think not only about what you need to have prepared, but what are relatively safe locations to store them as well.
Okay, good. You've painted the picture very well. So we don't know after a disaster what condition the infrastructure, the local infrastructure will be in. And also we don't know how safe, what shape our goods are in that we've pre-placed there. So what is the remedy to that?
Well, I'd say some of the core ideas have been to do things like maybe put things in the more risky locations that are easier to replace. Like you can get more food and water easier than some things that are more expensive. Mm. For example, one of the lessons that the Red Cross talks about that they learned from Katrina is those debit cards they give out to people that are affected by a disaster. Those are made in China, and they're hard to suddenly get 10,000 of those. So they put those things like that in Little Rock or Atlanta, where they're still relatively close to where hurricanes tend to hit the United States, but in a safer location so that they're less likely to be damaged, and only put easier, cheaper things to replace in more dangerous locations.
Mm-hmm. I understand you've been studying this area for something like 15 years at least.
Yeah, I was motivated by the tsunamis that happened in Indonesia, and then we had Katrina, and all those events sort of motivated looking into this area.
Mm-hmm. As you've become acquainted with this, more than acquainted, intimately sort of aware of what this problem is all about, how much can we improve compared to what we're doing now? How much better can we be at bringing in relief supplies in a timely fashion? Because this can cost lives more than anything in business, for instance.
Absolutely. And I think we've gotten a lot better, particularly in large locations like the mainland of the United States. We can pre-position power trucks and goods so that they can come in quickly when the disaster happens. Also, we've gotten so much better at doing things like traffic flow management. If you notice, like Charleston, they had both sides of the highway going in the same direction. So we've gotten much better at evacuation. But I think the one core issue that still really needs help is islands, is because islands have such a bigger challenge. Mm-hmm. Is they don't have a lot of safe places to store things. And then when the disaster happens and it destroys their port or their airport, like we saw with the Freeport Airport in the Bahamas, it's taken several days. They have a real lag in getting supplies. So I think islands still remains a big challenge, like Puerto Rico as well. So that's why I have one of my current PhD students, Vahid. We are looking specifically at what can we do better for islands, because I think some of the abilities we have to prepare on the mainland don't transfer as easily to islands. They have a little bit harder.
We only have about a minute left, Anne, but what can you tell us about how your research has been used? Have you found it's been applied with success?
Well, as a professor, most of the things are academic publications that are out for public access. So I get emails and feedback that way, but I haven't worked directly with mm-hmm. an aid agency. Except I have been working with the Iowa Flood Center here to be looking at how we could predict flooding and things in Iowa in combination with roads to figure out where locations in Iowa would be safe if a big flooding event happened in Iowa.
So applications for your work also here in Iowa, not only in hurricane-stricken parts of the world and the country. Thank you so much. Anne Campbell, professor in the Department of Business Analytics at the University of Iowa Tippie College of Business. Thanks for coming in again.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know Amazon has made its way into most Americans' lives. For many of us, not a week goes by without an Amazon package being slipped into our mailbox or schlepped to our front door. I feel sorry for those men and women who have to do that sometimes, by the way. Well, Amazon's latest bid to become an even bigger part of our lives is called Ring. Maybe you've heard of it. This is the Ring video doorbell that offers customers convenience, a sense of security, but it's also attracting some scrutiny. Joining me to talk about it, Paul Brennan, news director at the Little Village Magazine. It's an independent magazine covering news, culture, arts in the Iowa City, Cedar Rapids area. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
You've written in your latest article about how the Iowa City Police Department, also we should mention the Polk County Sheriff's Department, are part of a program that shares surveillance videos from Ring doorbells. First of all, tell us how Ring works with its companion app, the Neighbors app.
Right. Ring has the Neighbors app, which you download, and they refer to it as an opt-in app that allows you to sort of a social platform that allows you to share information with people in your immediate area. There's a 5-mile circumference from wherever you are. It's not really an opt-in. You have to have the app if you're going to make the Ring doorbell work or any of the other Ring products.
And this is a doorbell with a camera on it.
Yeah, it's with a hidden camera on it, as opposed to other sort of security cameras where you can see them and they're used to discourage people from engaging in questionable behavior. Mm. This is a hidden camera, so it doesn't make it look to your neighbors like you're suspicious of them.
Right.
Neighbors app allows you to share video from your doorbell, assuming you've opted in for the video recording package. That's a separate package. That's another fee you get from Amazon. So you pay $99 to $560, depending on what doorbell you get, then you pay $3 to $10 a month for video storage on the cloud.
And then you can choose to have a video downloaded onto your smartphone.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And they've started a partnership with police agencies around the country, or invited them to do so, and which allows the police agencies to request videos from the Ring doorbell users for a particular time in a particular area. There are only two agencies that are doing this currently in Iowa, according to Ring. And as you mentioned, Iowa City Police Department is one of them. Now, when I spoke with Sergeant Derek Frank, who is the public information officer at ICPD, he said that they don't have any information about where the doorbells are. They don't have any information about who uses them. They just use it as a way of requesting, the same way they would when they put out a press release asking if anybody has video in the area.
Mm.
I will say that according to the Associated Press, back in July, Ring does share more information with some police departments. Arcadia, California, for example, has a heat map of where the neighbors participants are in the area.
Hmm. Okay, so talk a little bit more about so according the sense I got from your article, according to the Iowa City Police Department, the public information officer, this is all well and good and it's fine, but there are others who have civil rights concerns here, and you've sort of brushed on those. Go into those just a little bit further.
There absolutely are. I mean, whether it's neighbors or Nextdoor, which is a social platform that allows people to share information about what's going on in their neighborhood, what journalists who have looked into these over the years and what sociologists who have been studying them find is that this leads to a sort of, whether conscious or not, racial profiling, because you're just trying to pick up on people who don't look like they belong in your neighborhood.
Hmm.
And
That's one reading of it, though, yeah. Right? I mean, it depends on the person who is looking at the video, right? How you interpret how someone appears to you.
Right. Although, actually, Ring is going to try to go beyond that. In December, Amazon filed some paperwork with the patent office saying that would allow them to incorporate facial recognition technology.
Oh.
Which they would then also have match up with a database of mugshots and also a database of suspicious persons, whatever exactly that means. Yeah. Now, Amazon has said in response to questions about this that they have no intention of actually rolling this out, which is a bit like saying I'm a dedicated pedestrian. And yes, there's an SUV in my driveway, but it's just there because I enjoy the engineering of it.
Okay. So what we're casting here right now is a way, if I hear you right, mm-hmm. Here, Paul, coming soon to an app near you, if mm-hmm. I can say that, it that way, somebody rings your doorbell, the video starts with your...
No, they don't even have to ring your doorbell.
Okay. So they're standing on your doorstep.
Yeah.
The video starts and you see an alert somehow, and then your app identifies through facial recognition who that might be if they're a suspicious person some way according to some criteria.
Right. And an important thing to note about facial recognition software, and Amazon already has a commercially available facial recognition software called Recognition with a K instead of a C in the word recognition because marketers like that kind of thing. And is that facial recognition software does not do well with people of color. It has a much higher rate of misidentification with them. In fact, the ACLU tested recognition in 2018 with photos of members of Congress, and it claimed that there were matches between 28 members of Congress and the mugshots that the ACLU fed into it. And most of them were members, people of color. So. Mm.
Another aspect that's interesting you mentioned in your article, Paul, is you mentioned that Gizmodo broke the news that Ring is trying to use its partnership with police agencies to get to people, to encourage, to use it as sort of a sales tactic, right?
Exactly, yeah.
To explain how that works.
Okay. This is actually how the partnership began with police departments. Ring was encouraging police departments around the country to participate in giving out coupons or even giving out Ring doorbells as a way of promoting security. But it was for the company, it's a way of selling product. Gizmodo found they were even writing sales scripts for the various police agencies around the country. Now, I will say Sergeant Frank emphasized that Iowa City will not be doing that at all, and said they wouldn't actually participate with Ring in the neighbors sharing program if it was just limited to Ring. They now have an for ISO and for Android. Even if you at Casa de Kiefer don't have a doorbell spying on your neighbors, you can.
I don't. You but
can,
go ahead.
You can download it to your smartphone and participate in the fun anyway.
Oh, all right. All right. So in the final minute or two we have here, Paul, you obviously looked into this in pretty good depth here in writing about it. Do you see in the future here what's going to come? I mean, obviously there's a value in having safe neighborhoods.
Right.
We all want to live in safe neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And having eyes in the neighborhood, we had those signs going back decades that this is a neighborhood watch area.
Yeah.
So this is a digital age version of that, more or less, with some other complications.
Well, can we balance the company's line?
Yeah, can we balance this out with the civil rights concerns? Do you see that happening with safeguards?
Probably, but let's face it, a for-profit company like Ring or Amazon doesn't particularly care about your civil rights unless they have to, unless they're compelled to.
Okay, how do we make them have to worry about that part?
Well, that's an interesting question. I suppose you could – there's been enough bad coverage, let's put it this way, for Nextdoor, which is an older version of this. Which is just a social media platform, that they have felt compelled to hire a professor of psychology from Stanford who's an expert on racial profiling to try to develop a algorithm that sends out kindness alerts, as it's called, to encourage people to stop describing people in racial terms and focus on other things.
Wow. This is fascinating. Our time has come to an end. Paul, I know we'll talk about this and other things that you're reporting on in the future. Fascinating. And a quick word to how you will be following up on this. Will you be?
Yeah. Obviously, we'll be looking for the ways in which it's being implemented by the ICPD. And it's a little trickier to actually sort of eavesdrop on the conversations. I'm not saying we're going to do that, but...
Okay. And people can find Little Village Magazine online,
I assume. Yeah, littlevillagemag.com. Remember the MAG, folks.
Littlevillagemag.com. Yep. Little Village Magazine, an independent magazine covering news, culture, and arts in the Iowa City and Cedar Rapids area. Paul Brennan is the news director for Little Village Magazine. Paul, thanks for coming in today.
Great to be here, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we'll meet a writer from Hong Kong who is visiting Iowa. Part of a group of writers who has come here from all around the world. Also, in our second half hour, we'll talk about how to avoid hazards on the farm during the harvest season. Harvest season already here? Is summer already gone? Yes, I guess it is. Also, coming up next week, this is fascinating. How satisfied are you with your home? Well, believe it or not, that can depend on its size compared to your neighbor's homes. We'll talk about dwellings, homes, trends next Monday on the program. But first, back with the second half hour of our News Buzz in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Welcome back to this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's become a fall tradition, almost as predictable as the falling leaves. This week, writers from around the world came to Iowa to take part in a 10-week residency put on by the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. In just a moment, my conversation with one of those resident writers, a man from Hong Kong who has been taking part in the protests we've been hearing about there. But first, a short conversation about the residency with IWP Director Christopher Merrill.
This fall, we'll be bringing 29 writers from 26 countries for a 3-month-long residency during which they will write and give readings and panel discussions and engage in a wide-ranging conversation in what we like to call the United Nations of Writers.
And this is not like United Nations behind closed doors. This is all, a lot of it, open to the public.
We will have probably close to 200 public events, all free, before the end of the residency in mid-November.
Remind us what the International Writing Program is all about.
Well, it's what we call our 3-month-long performance piece, but it's really an exchange of cultures, particularly of literary traditions, bringing together writers from all around the world to talk about what they do as writers, and then to engage in those longer and larger and more intimate kinds of conversations about what their countries are, what issues they're facing, and what the common problems are that writers everywhere face. What to do with the blank page, how to make this story come to life.
Over the coming weeks on River to River, we'll get to know these authors individually and have some longer conversations on Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, no doubt. You've got some writers from countries that have never been represented here before.
Well, for example, we have our first writer from Eritrea, who I learned today needed not only to purchase a passport to come to then secure a visa to come to this country, but also an exit visa from his own country. And Eritrea is a country that has perhaps 1% internet penetration. It has a strictly censored kind of approach to publishing. And here's somebody who's making a name for himself as a writer. So our first writer from Eritrea, our first writer from Namibia, writers from Latvia and Lithuania, from Argentina and Mexico, from Nepal, and you name it, writers from literally everywhere.
And what have you observed over the years at how these writers interact from such vastly different cultures?
Well, that's the thing that's so interesting, is that if writers break bread together on a regular basis, they find out that regardless of how divided they might be on political questions, particularly with their governments, they generally have more that unites them than divides them. And so political differences don't get necessarily brushed under the rug, but they are addressed in a different and, let's say, a more sophisticated way.
The Trump administration has a much different stance toward the rest of the world than we've seen in previous administrations in the modern era. How has that impacted your program?
Well, we are working in a completely different set of circumstances now. But what we do is what we've done through every administration, which is we are writers gathering together to talk about writing, about literature, and to try to become bigger and more interesting writers. That's the key thing. And I'm happy to say that we haven't had that many problems getting visas this year, despite the clampdown. Most of the writers have managed to get their visas. I will say that I think a lot of writers come to the International Writing Program wondering just what the hell is going on in the United States. And of course, they're here in Iowa during the run-up to the caucuses, so they have the chance to see lots of presidential candidates make their pitch to the voters of Iowa. I told them yesterday, if you don't run into a presidential candidate while you're here, then you will have effectively slept through the entire residency.
Well, Chris Mayer, I'll let you mingle with the guests and the writers here this evening at this welcome party. But first of all, before we go, tell us how listeners can get in touch with the IWP and find out about this slew of events over the next couple of months.
Well, first, go to our website, iwp.uiowa.edu, and you'll find the biographies of the writers, their writing samples, and a full calendar of events, readings every Friday in Shambaugh House, public panel discussions on Fridays at the Iowa City Public Library, readings at Prairie Lights on Sundays, film screenings, Global Express, dance performances. It's pretty entertaining. So,
thank you very much, award-winning author, essayist, and poet Christopher Merrill, director of the International Writing Program. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, each Friday over the next couple of months, while these writers are in Iowa, we'll be meeting some of them one by one here on News Buzz River to River. I spoke with several of them at a gathering to welcome all of the writers earlier this week. Let's meet the first one of the IWP writers here in Iowa this year, and he's from a part of the world we've been hearing about a lot in our news lately.
Hello, my name is Chenping Chiu. I'm from Hong Kong, and I'm a theater director and a playwright.
A theater director and a playwright from Hong Kong. Well, welcome to Iowa. Tell us a little bit more about Hong Kong. Of course, it's been in the news lately very much, and you come at an interesting time in your history. What are your thoughts about what's going on in Hong Kong right now?
How to say it? I think we Hong Kong guys gets up and down these days because of the protests, and the situation is getting worse and worse.
What is the goal of the protests?
You know, the goal is to first at the very beginning is to try to against the extradition bill. This is a bill that the China government can arrest people in Hong Kong.
And take them to China for prosecution.
Yes, yes, yes. And then, later it developed, escalated as a kind of anti-government protest, because for the past 10 years, I think we have suffered quite a lot of suppression from the Hong Kong government.
From the Hong Kong government. Hong Kong has an interesting relationship. It is an autonomous region that is actually part of China. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. But you know, there is the so-called one country, two system. So the China government promised to give us freedom and also autonomy to a certain extent. But all these things are just night and night now. Yeah.
That was part of the deal when Hong Kong ceased to become it used to be a British colony.
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you old enough to remember rule as a British colony?
Yes, of course. I still remember quite a lot of memories. How is say that people now tend to have kind of nostalgia about the days under the British government, because at that time we did enjoy quite a lot of freedom. If we, the people, trying to voice out some discontent, the government will listen and will change the policy, but not now.
Not now. Why not?
Not now. Not now.
You don't think the government will change?
You mean the Hong Kong government?
Yes.
Of course, we are looking for that, but it's really, really, really difficult. And I think after that protest, I think no one, almost, of course, quite a lot of people in Hong Kong now, we really don't believe the government anymore, forever.
Have you, Chu, been out in the streets as a protester in Hong Kong?
Yes, yes, I've been there. I joined almost most of the peaceful protests. Mm-hmm.
What is that like? What are those protests? What is the feeling there with your countrymen?
It is kind of a very good feeling. We ever experienced that kind of solidarity. You can see people shouting, chanting at the street, and then one people saying, "Hong Kong Yan," and other people will echo, "Ga Yao."
What does that mean?
Means Hong Kong guys, at oil, brave up, mm-hmm. fight. Stand for fighting.
Do you have fears about what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989, yeah. happening in Hong Kong?
Yes, of course, of course. How to say? Some people say that actually the June 4 massacre has already repeated in different form.
A different form of the Tiananmen Square massacre?
Yes.
In a different form. What do you mean?
It means, of course, there are no tanks, and there are not so, up to now, no people die, but you see already 1,000 people have been arrested. And a lot of bloodshed in MTR station, in the corner of the street, everywhere, in almost every district in Hong Kong. So the fear is developing. But of course, the people, the brave of the people also is developing. We try to stand against that kind of fear.
Mm-hmm. You are a theater director and a playwright in Hong Kong, Chu. How does your work, what is your work, what are some central themes of your work?
Mainly for my original written work, usually is about the Hong Kong identity and different periods of Hong Kong history.
What do you hope to get out of this residency? I don't know how well acquainted are you with the United States? Have you been to Iowa, for instance, before?
Sorry, pardon?
Have you been to Iowa before?
No, I haven't been here before.
Have you been to the United States before?
Yes. 18 years ago, I have been in New York, yeah.
Okay, so you've been in New York 18 years ago, and now you're in Iowa.
Yes.
That's a contrast.
Yes, quite very different. You know, the New York house is very free flow, no one will, how to say it, no one will notice you. Whatever you dress and
no one will notice you. You can do whatever you want.
Yes. It's just, for me, it's not really very real. I think it's kind of parallel worlds.
A parallel world?
Yes.
How so?
Yes, very strong. Just like it's totally different, opposites to Hong Kong, especially. Yeah, every time when I get down on the street in Hong Kong, it's this thousands and thousands of people. But when the first night I arrived at midnight, and then the next morning, yeah, I have a walk around the hotels and
in Iowa City.
Yes. There's almost no people.
What did you think?
But I think this is normal. I think in this planet there should be some kind of life. It's like that.
Yeah. Right. Well, Chu, to finish up here, what do you want to accomplish here as a writer? During the residency?
Actually, before I come, I have no idea. But, you know, after the protest is becoming more and more tense, I really want to do something. But it is very extremely difficult, especially in Hong Kong. Sometimes you think that arts and theater is no use at this moment. But after these few days I arrived, I start thinking about this is my responsibility.
So what can art and theater do in this situation in Hong Kong?
I think some people are right. We can't do anything at this moment. But I think arts and theater can do something that for the future, when people try to experience one more time in another angle, or maybe in a more authentic angle, perspective, to see what happens in our society.
Very good. Well, Chu, I want to thank you for this conversation, and I wish you all the best in this residency. Wish Hong Kong all the best in the future as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chanping Chu, what a pleasure to talk with that theater director and playwright from Hong Kong at a gathering earlier this week, a gathering of International Writing Program writers. They'll be in residency over the next 12 weeks. And here on River to River News Buzz Fridays, we'll be featuring short conversations with a number of them. We're looking forward to that in the coming weeks. Well, with the harvest season fast approaching and the National Farm Safety and Health Week later this month, let's take a few minutes to address how best to avoid hazards on the farm. Joining me, Chuck Schwab is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
Let's just get right to it. What are the top concerns when it comes to farm safety at harvest time?
Well, we have so many different activities that are going on. So it's a lot of tasks, a lot of communication. And again, activities create possibilities for injuries. And so those are things we need to look for. And we're looking at augers, slips and falls, tractor overturns, collisions. So it's a wide range of activities.
Mm-hmm. And one had conversations about this many times in the past, but it was described to me, not having worked extensively on a farm, somewhat, when I was younger. Tell me if this rings true to you. There's so much repetition on farm work, in farm work, things you do 100 times, but it only takes one time of not paying attention to safety for a tragedy to occur, right?
Well, that's part of it, yes. A very accurate assessment. Sometimes you become immune to the danger that exists if you are exposed to it on a regular basis. The other option is that, like you said, you kind of get into a rhythm of how things are happening. And one of the things that you see is that maybe that rhythm has been disrupted. You have a breakdown or something else has occurred, and you get out of that rhythm. And because you're out of that normal rhythm, it might put yourself at a higher risk of injury. And talking in generalities, but you have a sequence of events that you normally do, mm-hmm. and if something interrupts that sequence of events, then you might not remember that you still need to lock the equipment or the hydraulic arm or turn off the equipment. It might have interrupted your normal sequence, and then that creates the hazard that injures you.
Right. For instance, a few years ago, I spoke with a young Iowa woman. She had her arm mangled in an auger. For those who don't know, this is like they drill like fence posts with these, right? These are large, like large drill bits, you can think of them, right?
And sure.
She had the crew she was working with, the auger had just been turned off, but it was still rotating. She nearly lost her arm, and she came to talk with us to warn others. Exactly what you proposed there, Chuck, is that you have to pay attention to really detail, and being a little bit off can really be a problem. Talk about some other aspects. Power lines are something that we worry about in farm work as well, isn't it?
Well, yes. And when we're doing in this harvest time period, we're moving these augers from one bin to the other as we're filling up the harvest. And if we're not taking precautions, those are often items that hit overhead power lines. And so, you don't think about it until this time of year, and then sometimes perhaps maybe someone new is operating and they're not identified that there is a issue and how to do it correctly. Or again, you might be running into a time crunch and you're trying to do something a little faster without lowering the auger before you move it. And so all these things play into the you're just having to have that awareness that the choices you make have an impact on your health and safety.
Also, we don't have time to go in depth, but also non-farmers being safe around farm equipment that's moving in our highways and on our county roads of two. Of course, keep your distance if it's a slow-moving farm vehicle. Slow down in good time, brake in good time. Don't create a hazard by trying to get around these things quickly. Chuck Schwab, thank you very much. Professor in the Department of Agriculture and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's join IPR Studio One Tracks host Mark Simmet to groove us into the weekend. We have time for one tune. You got something to groove us with, Mark?
Oh, yes, always, Ben.
Of course.
We have something. Could we let you down on that? No.
No. unless we talk too much, then we won't have time.
Well, we better be sure to get this in then. Frankie Cosmos is who we're going to hear from. Frankie Cosmos, you're saying? Well, she's actually the daughter of a couple of famous parents, Kevin Kline and Phoebe Cates, the actors. Her name is Greta Kline in the real world, but she records and performs as Frankie Cosmos. She started out very interestingly, a talented musician and songwriter who was able to make her own music and release it on mainly on the Bandcamp site. And that attracted attention. She's been making actual studio albums now for the past few years. And the band now has come to be known as Frankie Cosmos. The latest release from Frankie Cosmos is a new album, and it is called Close It Quietly. And this is A Joke.
One, two, three.
Joke to end the show from Frankie Cosmos. Certainly no joke, the work with Shirley Wong on this program. We want to thank her in closing here for the skill, the expertise. We'll miss you and your friendship. You're moving on to bigger and better things. We'll look forward to hearing about your future successes in media work. Thank you so much, Shirley. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.